Hello, you are very welcome to episode 211 of the Game Pit podcast, a podcast about modern tabletop and especially board gaming. My name's Ronan. I am your host today, flying solo on what is a review show. And I'm going to be covering six games which I have been playing recently. Now, I'm going to kind of twist up the format. There's usually a boring thing to talk about. When podcasts start talking about the inner workings of podcasts, I always get bored. So forgive me, but I wanted to highlight it for a reason. You know that we started doing scores for these games, and when I looked at the six scores for this episode, they were all fairly close. They were within fewer than 20 points of each other. And it occurred to me that the type of game for each of these six games, they all do something a bit different, a bit of a twist on something. Of course, that's what every game does, but more so in this case than in others. And to me, the type of game it is and how much you enjoy that type of game is probably more important to listen to than it is what I actually think of them and what my score is. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take, and now I try to find a nice way of phrasing this, the one that I like least to go first and then work my up to my personal favourite. Like I say, I think it's just personal preference for the style of game is what has ended up mostly putting these to any sort of an order. So I think the more interesting feature is whether you like this type of game. And I hope that kind of makes sense. Enough blathering about that. Well, blathering. I didn't mean to do that. I think the word blathering was the name of a game by Bez. And the first game is a game by Bez. Now remember, I like them all. Doesn't mean this is a bad game. Last time I'm going to say that. This is 2022, a game about selecting seven cards and speedily searching for synergies. 2 to 6 players, takes 3 to 5 minutes to play. From that playtime, be able to know it's kind of a fun, very quick, gimmicky, throw the game down. And like a lot of Bez's, interesting, innovative designs. And what she's done here is, there's a deck of cards. For the majority of them have pictures on there, and it's going to be pictures of creatures with various amounts of limbs, arms and legs, with eyes. There's also going to be details on there like forks and wine glasses and different sort of small illustrations, and Bez does them all herself. And you're going to have certain scoring cards and then also sort of certain negation cards. And everyone gets a hand of 3 and you choose one to start with. And that's going to be the start of your hand of 7 cards. From the deck, 9 get put face up in the middle of the table and everyone has their own personal little deck. And then it's just go, real time. Do you want any of the 9 cards in the middle of the table? If so, you pick it up and then you flip the card of your deck over and replace it. So in theory, there's always 9 in the middle of the table. Now, 3-minute playtime, people grabbing cards and grabbing cards. You know that there's not always going to be exactly 9 in the middle of the table. Sometimes you look down and go, there's 3 cards here. What's going on? Everyone flip a card. And it gets very hectic. And what's most important about it is that you're not just grabbing any old card. It's that you're trying to find synergies exactly in the name of the game. You're trying to find, like this one will say, 2 points for every fork you get. Another one might say, this is the only creature you can have, otherwise you get no points whatsoever. And things like that, whereby it's not just grabbing for anything that's down there all going to score you points. The vast majority of cards are not going to score you points unless you trigger them somehow. And like I see, there's the negative effects as well. Once someone's filled their hand to 7 cards, they just start counting down from 7 to 0. How quick they do it depends on what kind of a horrible person they are. And if you've ever counted particularly quickly with me, you're listening and you know who you are. Then, if you've got any cards left in the deck in front of you, you've got to pick them up and add them to your hand. Maybe a good thing. You may get some cards there that help you. Quite often, you're going to get a load of nonsense in there or things that just completely invalidate what it was you were carefully trying to do. So there is definitely an urge to get cards and pick them up. And sometimes just picking up a card that's not going to do anything to your hand at all is much better than just standing there and waiting and waiting and waiting. Just grab a card. That's not going to mess me up. Maybe I'll score out of it later. And just keep cycling. So it's frenetic. It's frantic, it's grabby. You'll know if you enjoy that sort of a game. And if you do, a game about selecting 7 cards and speedily searching for synergies is a fun experience. And it's my one I'm kicking off with for today. The next game I'm going to go on to is another kind of party group experience. And it's one that's got a lot of buzz, certainly amongst podcasts and stuff like that. It's another 2022 game. It's Green Team Wins. So it's about 15 minutes to play. I think that's ambitious. You've got 15 questions to get through in every game of it. I think 30, 40 minutes is much more likely as a time frame. It's 3 to 12 players, but you do need two sets to be able to play up to 12 because there's only six of these whiteboards in the game and everyone needs to get their own whiteboard. It's by Nathan Thornton and 25th Century Games. And the reason everyone's getting their own whiteboard is that you make a deck of 15 questions and there are three different types, you get five of each. Fill in the blank, this or that, multiple choice. So fill in the blank will be like gold blank or blank door, wherever it might be. Then everyone around is going to write secretly their own answer. And then they're going to turn them around and everyone's done and everyone can see them. And whichever is the most popular answer is the correct answer. Not what's right, not what's wrong, but just what's been chosen most by the group. And then you're going to score points depending upon what team you were in the first place. So if you are on the green team, how you get on the green team, we'll get to that in a second. But if you're on the green team, you score 2 points. In order to get on the green team, you must get an answer correct. When you get an answer correct, you get to say, I now am on the green team, and you score 1 point. So that's how everyone's going to start the game, by scoring the 1 point and getting on the green team. If you're wrong, it doesn't matter if you're on the green team or orange team, you're now on the orange team, and you're going to score 0 points. And the next time you get a right answer, it's going to be a point, and then you'll be on green team, and then you score 2 points. You're trying to get runs off huge, big, you know, finger air quotes, the right answer. There is no right answer. You're just reading the group around you and trying to work out what's the most likely answer from this bunch of reprobates I'm playing with. Good things about green team wins, it can be played by anyone. It's not gamey at all. It's almost a bit strange that I've heard about it on board gaming podcasts. I guess this is what happens when party games come out that gamers can also enjoy. And this one is so simple but works that gamers can also enjoy it. I think it's just that scoring system and the fact that it's a fun time. Very group dependent. That is standard with any party games. It can be the same with a game about selecting seven cards and all the rest of it. You need, to me, and maybe this is just a reflection on myself, you need to have a little bit of a chat about the answers afterwards. Otherwise, what's the point? It becomes very mechanical and the questions themselves aren't that interesting. It's the answers they create and then the possible disagreements and agreements and the shifting alliances of, oh yeah, obviously it's that. And oh, how could you possibly answer that when there's no right answer? It's just, you're making it up. It's all good. I find that it plays best when you curate the questions. Some of the questions that they're kind of standard. They're obvious, which again, the fun doesn't come from the questions. It comes from the answers and the debate around the answers. But it hasn't got that real creativity within it to really make you think outside the box. But then if it did, you wouldn't get enough of the same answers for the scoring system to work. So it does have to be kind of fairly vanilla in what it's asking you. Well, you'd think there's only a few valid questions, but as soon as you get a bunch of people together, a few valid answers, but as soon as you get a bunch of people together, they start coming up with some wild things and you're like, that's the first thing you think of. When you think of dog, you're something dog, that's the first thing you think of. What the hell? Anyway, people are warped and we live in a much more fragmented media society. That will definitely come to you. It's functional, it's fun, it's interactive. You can have a laugh with each other. It doesn't do anything that's mind-blowing to me, but it's so flexible that despite the fact it's like not my favourite party game in the world, it's one I'm going to keep because I can just use it with so many different groups of people. So that was Green Team Wins. I'm going to move on to a slightly bigger game, Tesseract, from 2023, 1 to 4 players, 60-minute playtime-ish. It's from James Fernhaber, it's his first design, and it's from Smirk and Laughter. And Tesseract is a co-op puzzle. There's an alien artifact appeared, and it was pretty huge when it first appeared, and now it's shrinking and shrinking and shrinking, and handily for us, it is now the size, exactly, of a cube of 64 dice. And those dice are in 4 different colours, and the 6 numbers 1 to 6, although they've got their own sort of styly versions of numbers 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 and 6 on them, which looks quite cool. Anyway, what the team are attempting to do is take actions to draft dice from this cube, which goes in the middle, and it sits on a Lazy Susan, and you can spin it around to have a look at it all over. And when you take dice, they come into a card in front of you, which is called your laboratory. And then you're looking to manipulate them, because what you're trying to do once you have them in front of you in your lab is to create sets of 3, 4, or 5. Either they're going to be the same number in different colours, or if they're the same colour, they need to be ascending, like runs of numbers. So 2, 3, 4, 2, 3, 4, 5. You're getting the idea. And you can take actions in order to manipulate them, and you're choosing which dice to take, and they have to be available. They have to have at least 2 sides free for you to be able to take them. In taking them, there's a choice there, because the Tesseract itself will shrink, so it will lose dice as the game goes on continually, and it will always take from the lowest level it can possibly take from. So the problem with that is that once a column gets completely depleted, one of the 16 columns, there's a bad trigger underneath it, because depending upon the level of difficulty you've chosen, your Tesseract will sit on a grid, and as the column goes, the symbol at the bottom of the grid is exposed, and that will trigger bad things for you. Luckily, you have got powers. You can take actions to pass dice to each other, as I say, manipulate them up and down. You choose characters at the beginning of the game, and each of you then has an individual way in which you can interact with the game, interact with these dice. However, as the Tesseract is shrinking, as the dice come off it, they go into this sort of danger area. And if you ever get three of the same number, it's going to trigger, like outbreaks in Pandemic, if you have too many of those triggers, you're going to end up losing the game. If all the dice disappear from Tesseract, then you've lost the game. So what you're trying to do in order to win the game is make sure you've studied one of each possible combination. So 24 dice, the six colours in each of the four numbers. So when you create a run, you take one of that set that you've studied, it's called, and you're going to put it onto a different grid. Now, that grid is where you keep track of which combinations. So if I've got one purple two, I don't need to study a purple two again, and blue four and all the rest of it. But also, each time that I've studied all the four different colours off a number, I'm going to trigger a big power for myself. And those six powers, you don't know what they are, you flip them over, and they can be game-changing. But that's not the only powers you can trigger in the game. There are these study cards, and you start with level two ones, but there are various ways in which you can go up. And you can either kind of knock dice out from this danger zone, or you can study and get more powerful cards which you can use on your turn. And they go to level three, and then rather than using them, you can upgrade them to level four, and the four ones are incredible and game-changing. And it's those powers that very much add to the momentum of the game of Tesseract, because when it starts off, you don't feel like you can do that much. The dice are disappearing quicker than you can imagine. It's going to be very difficult to do this. We can do very little. But by kind of powering through and carrying on and just kind of slow, keeping on top of this problem, you will end up unlocking these big powers. And like I say, one or two of them can swing the whole momentum of this game. And the whole thing accelerates. And you do have a feeling that it's collapsing, this Tesseract. But also we're learning more as it collapses. And it does feel slightly thematic in what can feel like a bit of a dry game. It is, however, quite hard to judge how it's going when you're in the midst of that, because you will always feel like it's going badly. It can be hard to judge what's your priority at any one time, because it turns out that what you were doing very suddenly cascades, and I was managing this area of the problem, but suddenly this is an area of a problem. And because dice get rolled before they go into the sort of the danger area, you never know exactly what's going to go into the danger area. And so you have to kind of flow with these different problems, and suddenly this card you've been sitting on that looked completely useless, this power, which you might have thrown away because you're thinking, oh, this is no use to me, you're suddenly going, oh, hold on, that could really, now it's changed, it's situational. But not knowing which situations are going to be key can leave you with a bit of a feeling of slightly being lost during Tesseract and not able to read strategically the entire story of the game. Now, I've talked about we've got all these different powers. Despite that, over several plays, I did feel that Tesseract got a little bit samey. You are just manipulating the same sort of sets of dice. You are doing the same things with them. You're either putting them up or you're putting them down, and you're trying to get them in runs. And despite the fact it's a great production, the Lazy Susan is a really cool. There's an Etsy hand. So on the cover of the game itself, it looks like Tesseract's being held by a purple hand. And on Etsy, you can get like 3D printed ones to hold the Lady Susan in. And it looks really cool. I think the hand goes on it and that holds the dice. Anyway, whatever. So it looks really lovely. It's very well made. It's very clear. It's clinical for a reason, because of this sort of science and studying and a laboratorial theme to it. But it's hard to get excited about individual games of it. And even though they've given you four different difficulty levels in there, to me, the difficulty levels just meant that the fulcrum, the pivotal moment, just came slightly later. So you were panicking for slightly longer before you got this sudden cascade of power, 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 power. Unlock the twos, unlock the fours, unlock the fives. We've got level four card. Bang, 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 bang. It's all under control. We've won this. And often you'll know you've won before you've actually won. And the lower the difficulty level, the earlier on in the game that tends to happen. You tend to have to go through a certain amount of pain before you can say, we got this, it's all cool. That might all sound negative. It's not negative. This is my fourth favourite game of a decent bunch of games that I enjoyed all of them. I enjoyed playing Tesseract. I played it several times. It just didn't stick around because I felt I'd seen everything within the game, within those few plays that I had. So it's not genre busting. It's more, if you like, sort of puzzly co-ops. Certainly worth giving a go. If you see it in a board game cafe, get a chance to borrow it or whatever, because it's not that hard to learn and it all makes sense. And it's a very pleasant physical game. And it's a slightly different way of working out your brain. So not top notch, but I did enjoy Tesseract a fair amount. So we're talking about mechanisms and types of games, the sort of types of games you might like. I split, you choose. To me, it seems to be having a little tiny bit where we talk about Renaissance a lot recently, the Renaissance, the trick-taking Renaissance. Anyway, I Split You Choose does appear to be becoming slightly more prevalent and being used slightly differently within games, and I'm enjoying that. Red Cat Games and Evgeny Pedrov have come up with the idea of Rome in a Day 2023, 2 to 5 players, to make a 20-minute I Split You Choose game. Is it Rome? Is it in a day? Is it a standardised split you choose with simple scoring? Well, it's more the latter than it is the former. It's definitely, when you get there, you get some tiles and you get a gem and you get 2 buildings each turn. And the buildings are the same colours as the tiles. There are a mix of colours of them. And you're going to create an offer and you're going to show it to the person. You either go left or right, depending on what round it is. There's only 4 rounds in the game. And then they are going to choose which of the 2 halves they want. This gem that comes with it always goes with the smaller offer, because there's an odd number of things that you're offering, must always be a smaller offer. And then the person takes what they take and you take what you take. And the tiles are within these colours and you're laying them out next to each other. And then the buildings, what you want is them either on a space of the same colour or adjacent to, because the area of tiles the same colour is multiply the number of buildings which are on or adjacent to it, and that's your score within that colour for each of those different areas. And it's not going to be many. It's a very small tile building, area building, I Split You Choose game. The gems puts a twist up into the scoring, because if you get a few gems, they're worth a few points. Then if you get to sort of like the middle area, where you might be getting 1 around, or you know, 1 and a bit around, 4 or 5 of them, scoring kind of slows down. But then if you get loads of them, the scoring really ramps up again. And that's quite interesting. And you're like, do I really want to go for gems here? Because I've ended up with a few of them from the first couple of rounds and I want to go for it. I don't want to go for it from the start because it's worth quite a few points. So that's something you were thinking about. But you very much have to think about the other players as well, because the buildings are the key to this. Everyone has the same sets of tiles. So it's kind of limited into what tiles you're going to see. Everyone at the beginning of each game gets a card which tells them these are your 2 buildings which are available for the 4 rounds. And it's all asymmetric. And if you're not playing with 5 players, all the buildings aren't going to come into play. So you can see the pool of buildings that are going to be available to you and the players either side of you. And what rounds. And you can see, you can have an idea of what tiles each person's put out. So what tiles have they got left? You can start thinking about. And what buildings have they got left? And hold on, that only might have 1 white tile in it. But there are 3 white buildings between us about to come out. And I haven't played any of my white tiles. So there's 3 buildings, a bunch of white tiles available. So what looks obvious now isn't quite as obvious. I'm trying to make out like this is deep thought. This is a 20-minute game. But it's a 20-minute game where you'll spend about 16 minutes of it really sweating, because the actual putting together for the scoring is very simple. Is this the best place to put this? Probably. Yes. Or don't forget to leave myself a chance, because I don't want to block my purples off over there, so I'll put that 1 space to the left. Not too much thought on that side. It's the building up to the scoring that is by far the most interesting. And you start off, as usual, with I Split You Choose. Is it 1 round, 2 rounds? Oh, I don't know. I'm not sure. By the time it's round 3, you're sweating. What? How did you get all those? Have you got 2 red buildings and there's more red buildings out? How'd that happen? I can't give you red tiles. But if I don't give you red tiles, you're going to take all the purple tiles that I'm scoring loads of points for. How do I do that? Very nicely done to condense the appeal of an I Split You Choose game into clear components, clear, I nearly said strategies, that might be too big a word, but clear plans on how you're going to score points, and clearly able to see what may or may not be important to the people that you are splitting for. It is just enough with the two twists of collecting the gems and the asymmetric buildings to certainly be worth the 20 minutes. If this was 45 minutes, I'd be like, it's too generic, it's too bland. But to play that quickly and to squeeze it in and to have, as Sean told me the other day, and he's going to tell you in an episode or two's time about an I Split Your Shoes game we played together, but every time you split, I just feel awful. I feel like I've done it all wrong. I'm like, yes, that's the feeling of a good I Split You Choose game. And roaming a day successfully makes you feel awful. The penultimate game is 2023's Patterns. Two players, 15 minutes long. Again, I think that might be a little bit longer than that. Trevor Benjamin and Brett J. Gilbert from Lookout Games. Now, Mandala, I spoke about it, was, I think, a bit of a hit, which is sleeper getting more and more attention. You see it in more and more people's list of favourite two-player games. It was about Mandala cards. It was colourful. It was about setting individual scoring for yourself for each of six different colours which you could collect. And it was about denying the card colours that were worth most to the other player, playing in a shared space. And I loved it. Rachel loved it. It was one of my top games of 2022. This is a Mandala game. So it does share certainly lots of thoughts and themes of it, and it shares the colour palette and what have you. But it's not cards this time. Patterns is a game about tiles which are laid out on a grid. There are 48 of them, and they're laid out face down, but you can see what colours they are. And there are six different colours, same as in Mandala. You start off with a tile of a colour. Every turn you're going to have one tile in your hand which you can play or not. And you're going to do one of two different things. You're either going to establish a group and set your scoring for that group. So you're not going to play a tile in that case. You're going to pick a tile on the board and you're going to flip it over and you're going to put, if you haven't put any out, you're going to put your 1 point marker on. So let's say I flip over a dark blue tile. I turn it over, I put my number one marker on there and I say any dark blue tile that is contiguous in an area of this is worth 1 point to me, apart from the one that I set the scoring with. And equally, my opponent cannot make a group of dark blue tiles that is going to touch or be orthogonally adjacent to the one that I'm setting up here. It can be used as a block, and it's also setting yourself up for scoring, although obviously 1 point per tile is not the most. And that's part of the timing of the game we're going to come back to. Or I can add to a group. And the way that I do that is I switch in the tile that's in my hand, and it goes face up, adjacent to something I've already set up. And then I pick up the tile that was underneath there. And that's how tiles get flipped. They never get flipped directly on the board. They come into your hand, and then you put them back out again, which actually makes them very mobile, which is a part of the game that you have to get used to, and that you look at the board and you say, oh, there's loads of these tiles next to each other. Yeah, that does help, but it's not necessarily important because you can pick them up and put them down. And that circulation of the two tiles, you have to have a plan in your head as to where you're going, what you're doing, the colour you pick up, you must have something that you can do with it. And it's very possible, certainly later on in the game, to pick up a colour and suddenly, there's nothing I can do with this, I'm done. And then the other person gets to do things before we finish the game, and you're stuck there going, oh, how did I let that happen? And what's interesting in Patterns, which Mandala doesn't have, is this spatial aspect and blocking and cutting each other off from a certain colour is very, very there. It is much more intense and vicious than Mandala is. Now, Mandala is sort of, yeah, it's vicious, but you feel like you're playing one step in the background. Maybe you're pulling the strings a little bit and, yeah, you're setting people up and you're stitching them up and you're scoring points. But it does feel a little bit less personal than in Patterns. You are in there. You are like, you cannot put a tile there. I am cutting you off. You're done. And it is right in your face. And you're like, no! And suddenly you realise you picked up a colour and they have a chance of blocking you off by taking the next turn if they notice it. And you're trying to sort of like do anything but let them notice that you've got an orange in your hand and the orange is really, really vulnerable. Because if they cut you off, you're in big, big trouble. It's a land grab. And that's what the scoring's all about. Now, I was saying I was going to come back to the timing of the scoring. You want to maximize your scoring so that you make the tiles in which you're going to get big areas worth 4 points or 5 points, or it's never going to happen, but 6 points. But if you wait too long, those opportunities will either be taken from you or completely destroyed. And what you'll end up with, and I've certainly done it in games of it, is your 4, 5, 6 tiles too late in the game, looking down going, I'm just going to score nothing with these because I was waiting for the perfect moment and the perfect moment never came. And now I'm going to have 2 tiles that are worth 4 to me and none worth 5 and none worth 6 because my opponent has spatially blocked me out. My opponent usually being Rachel, who's vicious and will certainly block me out at every opportunity because, you know, we're mean to each other, which is cool. It's exactly the way patterns should be played. So there is a timing thing to it. I feel it's a bit more direct and stressful than Mandala. Well, we play Mandala loads and loads and loads. We play Patterns a few times. It hasn't quite got to the level of its sister game. However, that's a very high level. And Patterns is my second favourite game of all of these of this episode. We're going to play it again. I'm keeping it. It certainly feels like a clever iteration of themes from within Mandala without being a complete copycat of it. And I think that's very cleverly done as well. And if we're feeling like we particularly want to have a real fight with each other, then Patterns is one of those two-player games that we'll get out and know that there's going to be some sweat and bullets going on. So I've talked about games where, do you like real-time grabbing of cards? Do you like team games in which you're interacting and chatting to each other? Do you like co-op puzzlers? Do you like I Split You Choose? Do you like vicious two-player games? But this last one is definitely the oddest fish of all. It's The Barracks Emperors, 1-4 players, 120 minutes, Ray Farrell, Brad Johnson, GMT in 2023. I'm going to say at some point, so I think I was going to avoid saying a trick taker with a twist. That isn't necessarily a very helpful description, but it is an accurate one. So I guess this is something we're going to come back to. I feel like I had to get that phrase out. I hate saying it, but I had to get it out of the way. Right. Ray Farrell and Brad Johnson are the designers of Time of Crisis, and this is called a Time of Crisis game. Time of Crisis was a GMT game about 3rd century Roman emperors just spinning around, a turnstile of emperors, and you were in the background manipulating the military, the politics, and the vox populi, the populace, the mob, in order to get your candidate into emperor for at least some of the game and to score points in various ways. Now, I don't know why it's called a Time of Crisis game, other than, yes, it's got the theme, as in it's the same thing and there's loads of emperors and you're going to be supporting them and not supporting them. It's got the colours of yellow, red and blue, and the theme comes through in that you're going to play cards with special powers, and thematically those powers are linked to the same three areas of politics and military and the mob, but they are very, very different games. In The Barracks Emperors, you're going to play over 3 rounds and there's a grid. And in the grid, it's checkerboard, there are 13 emperors, each of which has a colour, yellow, red or blue, and they are waiting to be won. And the way you win them is by winning a trick, a comparison of cards orthogonally adjacent to that emperor. And if the emperor is red, you're looking for the most powerful red card. And if there's no reds adjacent, you're then looking for the highest number. And same with yellow and same with blue. And in The Barracks Emperors, you are going to be playing cards out your hand. You have a hand of 4 cards. Majority of them are yellow, red or blue. There are a couple of special cards in there which we can come back to. And when you put it into play, because it's a grid, now there are some spaces around the outside where this isn't entirely true, but it's similar, you tend to be affecting 4 different emperors at once. And in effect, in the trick-taking aspect, you're affecting 4 different hands of these 13 hands of cards. So if I put down a 7 red adjacent to a red emperor, and adjacent on the side in which that 7 red counts to that emperor for me, if you can imagine, let's say that's north, to the east sitting of me might be Rocky. My 7 red is now Rocky's card for that emperor. And then to the south, so directly opposite, it might be Rachel. That 7 red is now her card for that emperor. And then to the west of me might be G. And then that card is G's card for that other emperor. So I've played at 1 emperor, but it's affecting them on 3 other emperors. And equally, as other players play cards, it's going to be affecting me on different emperors. And you have to consider the 4 different tricks as you put it down. Now, part of the interesting thing is it only generally affects 4 tricks for the beginning part of each of these 3 rounds. Because as an emperor is 1, it comes out of the way. And suddenly you're looking at it going, I can put this down there because there's no emperor there, so it won't, for example, affect Rachel on this particular go because the space on her side is empty. And as the board narrows down, there are fewer emperors, then the decisions become slightly simpler-ish. But let's bring it back to how it becomes more complicated, because I mentioned it before. The vast majority of these cards also have special powers. So the military cards, the red cards, tend to mess somehow with other cards in the grid. They might knock something that's diagonally adjacent off. Bang, you're gone. And then with the yellow ones, the populist ones, it might be a case of you can get rid of an emperor or bring another emperor in. And they can mess with the grid. And it might be sounding like it's completely chaotic. And I think that's new players, and sometimes old players, and definitely me, sometimes you look at it and it's a bit overwhelming. You're like, oh, crikey. And you kind of have to narrow down exactly what it is that you're trying to do. So what are you trying to do? You're trying to win Empress. You're trying to win the tricks and you're trying to take them. Because, yeah, if it gets resolved and I've got the highest red, as we've been talking about, then great, I take that red emperor. Every emperor you win is worth 1 point. However, getting a set of red, blue and yellow is worth an additional 3 points. And soon enough, you're going to start getting into a case of, wow, I've got two reds, two yellows. I need to be concentrating on blues. So how am I going to do that? Well, when you play a card, you then get to draft the card back into your hand. It's not a blind draw from a deck. The draft is affected by the number of the card that you've played. If you played a 7 or an 8, you must take the card of the lowest value that's in the face-up draft of 4 cards. So you're giving yourself no choice. If you play a low number, you play a 1, there are 4 cards out of descending value, which you can now choose from. And yeah, sometimes you want to go for the highest number, but sometimes you want the power, or sometimes, like I'm saying, if I've got two reds and two yellows, I've got no blue emperors, I just want the blue that's on display. And sometimes when you're playing, it's not necessarily that I want to win this trick. Yes, an effect of the power, but also I want to make sure I've got a range of cards in my hand so that I can draft the really valuable ones as they come out, and they're going to be valuable to me. So you're aware of what the other players are doing. You're certainly aware of what other colour emperors they want. And all of this is going into your decision-making every time you play one card down. That's going to sound a bit overwhelming, perhaps, which is why Barracks Emperors is sort of headlining this episode of, does this sound like the sort of game you want to play? Because if it does, it's a good one. If it doesn't, probably step away from it. There are many aspects to like about Barracks Emperors. Playing on that shared board in the middle means that it is very much a shared experience. The fact that every single card play more or less affects every player, of that narrows down a bit towards the end, but more or less, means that you care what everyone else plays. And you care what they draft, because they can be setting themselves up for later on. There are barbarians around the outside, and you can play cards to move the barbarians around the place, because they just sit in a space that only affects you, giving you a zero power. But if you move them along, they can cover over other people's cards and cause them problems. And as emperors go, you can slide them into positions, which means they're not causing me any problem now, they're causing you a problem. And an unwinnable trick suddenly becomes winnable because you've had this barbarian attack. But then, like, some military cards are completely immune to barbarian attack. And that's where a little bit of the theme comes into it. Trick taker with a twist usually means a memory feat. Black 7 carries crow rights, but there's 3s that next round will mean that 7s are worth 4 less. But if you haven't got a piece of mistletoe behind your left ear, then every red cancels out every purple. You know what I'm saying. This is trick taking with a twist, but it's all in front of you. You can see it. You can see what's going on, and each play of it evolves. It starts off being a bit slow and generally people trying to work things out and the powers feel chaotic. But I do feel like it coalesces, and certainly within plays and over many plays, you do start to get an idea and you can remember, oh, hold on. Like, for example, the two blue eights, one had one power and one had a different power, but that blue eight's been played. So the damnation memory has been done. Fine, that's cool. That can't be done again anymore. And okay, that's all right. The red three's there, I mean, I can't attack it. So the other red three might be around somewhere. And that might sound like a lot, but it isn't. And I think it's helped by the fact that the same cards come up again and again and again. You're going through, you're getting the same cards out. They shuffle around 3 times. So even within one game, you're likely to see cards 2 or 3 times. So once you play 3 games of it, you've seen these cards 6, 9 times. And it's all coming in place. And the fact that their number and their colour go, you go, oh yeah. And you start to think, I know what these do. I know what that does. I know what they're after. You get the flow of it. you get the flow of the game. That doesn't mean it's not chaotic. There's plenty going on. People will screw you over. They'll put a card down and you'll shout and you'll curse. You'll wonder why they're handing the game to the person on your right and you'll cry about it. And then they'll do something else and then it'll turn out that you're winning and everyone will shout at you. But that is part of the aspect of one of these games where everything's open. It's stabbing people in the back to their face. And I like that. There's dickery going on all over the place. And it's not for everyone. But I have never played anything like the Barracks Emperors. Funnily enough, maybe for part of it, Tammany Hall is that overall, and now obviously big mechanical difference between them, but maybe overall, that's the feeling I get out of it where we're all screwing each other over. And it feels like you're in 13 fights, but actually you're not really. And some of them you're just going to have to let go, and other ones you're going to have to concentrate on. And other ones people will decide you're not in because they're going to play a card there in your space anyway. You go, well, I can't win that one unless I do. Oh, maybe I can. Maybe I play that and I draft that card and I use that to take that card out, then I'm in a good position to win that one. But is it worth me taking two or three turns to do that? Maybe it is, because it's that blue emperor I've been talking about that I really need that's going to score me 4 points. You know what I'm saying? So it's all these, you know, it's going on and you're thinking and you're interacting, and not every fight is worth fighting, but the threat of a barbarian over there might keep you in check while I just win this one over here. And I love that. Now, it is long for what it is. It's 120 minutes. I don't think your first game will get done in 2 hours. I think it will be a bit longer than that. I think you can get it under 2 hours if all four of you know it. And certainly it's going to be a much better experience if you have four players who have all played it before. Because that sort of naivety of play and the slowdown and having to read every card, I can't blame anyone for that. And it actually doesn't. I quite enjoy teaching this game, because every time I teach it, people have a dawning realization. You can see people sort of ding, 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 ding. Oh, yeah, I can do this. Oh, yeah, I can do that. And they're getting better and better as they play it. That doesn't mean they all love it. They all have that dawning realization, apart from one or two who just straight up were like, what? What's going on? What? That can happen. Then there's a bunch of people who'll play it and then they'll be like, yeah, yeah, I get it. I get this, I get that. I just don't care enough to put that much effort into this. What's an effective trick taker? And I get that as well. And then you'll get a bunch of people that go, wow, this is really cool. I'm really enjoying this. We can be really mean to each other and I'm all about it. If I can get four of those people and we can play together, Barracks Emperors will give me an amazing gaming experience. It's very good. But it's unique and it's odd and it's not always an easy first game and it's not for everyone. But it is my personal favourite of these six. But hopefully, having gone through those six games, you can understand my caveat at the beginning off. But listen to what I'm saying about how they play. Broadest appeal is probably green team wins, but I don't think that can hit the heights. There you go. If you feel like it, I recommend Barracks Emperors. That's it for this episode of The Game Pit. Thank you very much for joining me. Plans that Sean will be back with me next time with some reviews, because we've been playing games together. The Game Pit podcast is a member of the Dice Tower Network. Head to dicetower.com or Dice Tower on YouTube or Dice Tower at the Table podcast or wherever. There's loads of gaming content out there from the Dice Tower Network, and we'd be very happy for you to engage with some of it. Speaking of engagement, if you fancy chucking a review in wherever you heard this podcast, why not? We've been going for a long time. We don't get many reviews nowadays. I guess everyone who listens or listens has reviewed us. But if you haven't, then give us a shout out and let us know what's good or what's bad. Right, thank you very much. And we'll catch you next time on the Game Pit podcast. Music by E. Aaron. Boy, boy, boy.